Thank you, everyone, for coming. And yeah, we'll get started, because what I'd like to start is with actually introductions, and maybe if other folks are trickling in, they can still join us. So my name is Nick Tonebryant, and I recently finished my graduate work at Portland State University down in Portland. And I am elated that my wife and I were able to come this week to be able to share with you all. I have been studying international development for the last 4 years as part of my research, actually 6 years if you include the master's program. And my hope today is to invite you all and kind of dovetail into some of the conversation that Holden's already having. I really appreciated hearing more about some of the work that's being done to talk about how we're engaging with our rituals and our stories. So, as a preliminary kind of preface, I would say this is a very complex and messy subject, international development. And I will probably agree with most of you that there's no right answer to understanding a lot of these issues because of the complexity. And so my hope is to create a space where folks can kind of share some of the stories that they've internalized, that we can be a little bit more aware of those stories, and that we can create space for other folks to have differing opinions and be able to respect that. And also be mindful, you know, even as we have some conversations and I invite folks to be able to share, you know, who in the room has not been able to share, so that we can make sure that everybody feels included. And I also will throw out, I'm a conceptual pluralist, which, you know, after 4 years of higher education, I learned is just a fancy term to say there really is, there's not going to be a single right answer or perspective I'm going to be pushing here, but hopefully just inviting you into some of the questions. In terms of outline, here's what I'm hoping to cover. Some introductions, we're going to do an activity, discuss kind of the results of that activity. I don't know if it's typical, I actually should have asked. For folks who have been here before, is it typical to take like a little 5-minute stretch for the hour and a half sessions?
Just depends what you want to do.
Okay, well it's in there, and then we can talk about it if we want to do it. Then we'll have some other things that we'll be talking about this afternoon, or after the break. Perception versus reality, reframing development, and then another kind of perspective. But to begin, to give you a little context, for the last 4 years I've worked with the Sustainable Water, Energy, and Environmental Technologies Lab that recently moved with my advisor from Portland State University to Boulder, Colorado. And basically our lab, which also became this startup IoT, Internet of Things company that was spun out of our university, manufactures sensors like these that can be put on hand pumps and borehole pumps, latrines, pedestrian footbridges, basically just wanting to try and close the feedback gap that often happens in development projects. In global development, we often suffer from what's called the open loop. You have a lot of funding that flows from the West to the rest, often to support things like water filters, solar systems, cook stoves, latrines, or water pumps, but often with very little feedback from the folks who are using these systems. And this results in some sad statistics, like as many as 50% of hand pumps are broken within a few years of being installed in some African countries. Fortunately, thanks to the proliferation of cellular networks as well as satellite technologies, we have the ability to use some really simple sensors to try and figure out when things are not working the way that they should. And we can use the information from these very simple sensors not only to inform how things should be better operated or maintained, but also to gather data to see if our project outcomes are actually doing what they thought they would do, to better align our impact with our intentions. So in terms of introductions, I'd love it if we could go around. I love that this is out of order, it's awesome. So if you could share your name, your interest in this topic of global development, and if you're here just because it's raining and you are interested in learning in the subject, that is awesome. And then your response to this question. In general, do you feel like the world is getting better or is it getting worse? And I know this is a super unsatisfying question, but just as succinctly as possible. And you can add some small qualifiers like, you know, better this way, but whatever you feel like you need to in order to answer this with integrity. But I'm just curious. So I'm curious who would like to start. Maybe
I'll start.
Okay.
Sweet. I'm Doug. I'm here partly because it's raining. Partly I was actually hoping to hear your wife, but since you're here, that's fine.
Thursday.
Okay, there you go. And the world is not getting any better or worse.
Okay,
it's just pretty, nothing new under the sun.
Okay.
Or it's getting both better and worse.
Ah, but not necessarily one over the other.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we'll just continue going that way, if that's all right.
Well, good. I'm Todd.
Okay.
I was here because I was curious about this. Is the world getting better or worse? I think we spent 3 years in Africa.
Okay.
And you talk about pump panels that break and stuff like that. Our basic thing was Wawa. West Africa wins again because everything bad always happened. Anyway, I think with the technology and stuff that's coming up, that they can keep track of those pumps.
Yeah.
And even send somebody in when they do break because they've been notified that it's not working, rather than all the parts disappearing before they get there.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Thank you. Which country or countries were you in?
Liberia.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm Tiger. I'm real very much in, involved in world thought.
Yeah.
So that's what drives us here. And also, is the world getting better? I think it has the potential to be much, much better.
Mm.
And it's only getting worse if we fail our duties.
It's only getting worse if you fail?
If we fail our duties.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks. I'm Brenda. As a part of a local congregation, we're always doing stuff that impacts folks in a global way,
mm-hmm.
and I would love to have a little bit more hope that it's a positive impact that we're having.
Sure.
I feel like it's getting worse, but I suspect much of it's getting better, and I don't know it.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm Warren, and I like to say that I'm like recovering from working in global health philanthropy for a while. And I have to say that I think the world is getting better, because I think that's the only way that it's like, I don't know, that I can feel like continuing to be a part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Maybe we'll start back and then keep going that way, if that's all right.
I'm Asa. I've always been curious how some of these efforts, like engineers without borders, when they're doing stuff,
yeah,
how well they work and how long they work. And
sure.
This is an interesting question of what happens when they stop working.
Yeah.
In a place where there isn't any service coming and call that can help. I think in general, you know, the world is getting better, but I think as far as humanity is concerned, it's completely dim because of human nature is going to be not to act in those two ways.
Thank you.
Hanifa, I guess I've been interested for a very long time, but particularly in the 80s and the U.S. impact on foreign development and just what the huge impact we have around the world. And I think the world is getting better in many ways, but I'm with climate change facing us and not a very major response to it in many ways. It's kind of hard to see how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And climate change is going to impact poor people all over the world.
Right.
And it already has. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Barb, and I just love to learn. I like the title up here. I don't want to keep living with old terms. I want to learn how to respond or to think about what your subject is. And I think it's too general a subject to say whether it's better or worse, but I always have hope for the future.
Okay.
I'm Karen, and I'm here to learn. And in general, I guess I feel like it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
Thank you. Yeah, every response is a valid response.
My name is Astrid. I'm interested in your general topic. In a lot of ways, the world's getting worse, like with global warming and lack of transparency. A whole lot of things bother me that I do think are fixable if we make a concerted effort to fix them.
Yeah.
We have to make that investment.
Yeah. Thank you. We'll come back to the front.
I'm Dave, and I'm a technical person, aerospace engineering, but my family on both sides was agricultural farming, and I'm thinking the world is getting worse because everywhere I see, giant corporations are putting money into things and taking the individual benefits away.
Yeah.
Like in China, where so many of the people are going from rural setting to manufacturing and just becoming an element of a work machine.
Yeah.
I worry too about the internet and being able to ask global for everything and getting mm-hmm. a quick response that our attention span maybe is not deep thinkers, but just chasing after facts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a good source of information, so kind of both.
Yeah, you definitely, yeah, you see that both hands. Thank you.
I'm Sherry, and I'm here because this topic interested me so much. And I think the world is getting better because I think as a human society, we're able to focus more on what is wrong and try to fix it. Not that we're going to be successful, but we're more aware than we were in past centuries.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name is John. Lived and worked in Africa, Asia, and South America a little bit. And studied some development economics, but I'm all ears about what you figured out. Just to have a fresh, PhD level look at all this. I like the way you started. As far as whether the world's getting better or getting worse, there's some metrics that are better. I mean, I think infant mortality, some disease, some vaccination stuff, some health stuff, even education in general. But the climate change challenge to me is the most troubling one.
Yeah.
As well as I think it's a challenge for all of us to be more focused in our response, that we're all good-hearted people going in a million directions and not necessarily focusing our energy where it's going to count.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm Jane. I'm very interested in the topic, just to hear what first about it you have to say. And the question is the world getting better or getting worse? I kind of feel like in some ways it's a wash. Definitely getting better in a lot of ways, and I think the way that I feel really strongly that it's getting worse is that I just feel like there's a lot with less interpersonal depth. I'm around a lot of young people, and so I just see that lacking. We're focused on the immediate gratification and not a lot of interpersonal connection.
As a parent of young kids, I definitely feel a lot of that concern. Thank you.
I'm Cheryl. I'm a retired biology science teacher and member of Sierra Club. A lot of us probably are, and also Population Connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that things are going to get worse. They are getting worse. No matter what we do with these sensors and things that we come up with, as long as the population keeps growing at the rate it's growing.
Thank you.
I'm Christine, and I've traveled in some foreign countries, so I'm interested from that perspective. But I don't know if I can answer the getting better or getting worse, because like many of you have said, in some areas we definitely are getting better. I think technology as a whole probably has helped us a great deal. That through technology you can do things now mm-hmm. that were unthinkable years ago. And I know that people keep on saying, well, imagination and innovation is a big word that we use all the time.
Yeah.
But really, I do think that people have the capacity for making change and dealing with some of the problems that we have. So I tend to be optimistic in life, so I'll say better rather than worse. But we do have problems, and in all areas we have problems.
Yeah. Yeah, this presentation will not explain any of those away.
I'm Roy. I'm the son of a small-time farmer, and now the father-in-law of a son-in-law who is in agribusiness.
Okay.
So I'm curious about your topic from those perspectives and my own. I left the farm some time ago, but I've not forgotten where I'm from and where things might be going in that area, not only within the United States, but around the world as well. Mm-hmm. World getting better or getting worse? I'm kind of in the middle of that one, mm-hmm. but I remain hopeful and cautiously optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think there was one person who came in. Yeah, would you like to, or two people, if you'd like to share?
I'm Michael, and I guess getting better or worse is depending on what the standard is.
Sure.
That you're measuring against. Mm-hmm. And technologically, yes, it's awesome what we can do. As somebody said, interpersonally, and I think spiritually also, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
It certainly seems like there's more of a work ethic.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Marnie. I'm sorry, I might have had it in my mind that this started as brief.
No worries.
I just glanced at the front page of the Wenatchee Daily World hanging on a post across the mm-hmm. hall with a picture of the Pope asking, saying that he's praying for an end to the schism, and that's all I know. Hmm. The schism in the U.S., and I'm thinking, what is he talking about? Politically, religiously, I don't know what he's talking about, but is it getting better or is it getting worse? I guess something about our awareness of the problems and the depth of the problem is better than it has been before. Our awareness of disenfranchised people, religiously, genderly, economically, is better. I'm hoping that we will all rise to the challenge. I'm optimistic.
Thank you. The optimist will live longer.
Is that right?
So to begin, we're actually going to start with a pop quiz. So sorry for those of you who thought you'd put these pop quiz days behind you. Go ahead and take one and pass it along. It doesn't take too long, and I have some pens I'll be able to pass out as well. No, you already are. You're well pinned. You are? Oh, okay. You are
very good. Well, I'm postdoc, so I've got postdocs.
Yeah, you can kind of realize that there's that in the back of the board. Maybe just one more. Yeah. You can say you'll borrow. I'll
be one.
That's great. Did you get one for me?
Oh,
actually,
a couple of books.
About the 10.
Oh, yes, sorry. Can I need a pen? Okay. All right. I got two. I hope there's enough. There are 20. So. If there aren't, you can look over someone's shoulder. Do we run out of it?
No, there's a stack right here. Oh, you've got the stack.
Oh, I
got
people who
are handy. There we go.
Yeah.
We're gonna.
Is anybody need a pen over here?
Good.
Yeah.
I think
we've got. Just in case.
I think we managed to do it.
Wow. The multiplication of the clues.
I
You're talking about the life expectancy of the average person, not of the planet itself, right?
Correct. Yeah. Have I done this pretty well?
Just joking with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
The planet itself, the you know.
I did this when I was down visiting a university in Colombia in Bogota, and so I had to translate it back in Spanish and English, and I think I got that was rushed on my part.
Even your exclamation marks before and after.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was because I couldn't. I was like, how do you say pop quiz in Spanish? That pop please.
Well, actually, that's in Spanish.
I think I had said, they had maybe another way. It was like, yeah.
That's cute.
All right, so if you're still finishing up, I'm going to let you just do the last couple of questions. But just to give you a little context, this quiz, how many of you are familiar with Hans Rosling?
What?
He's a Swedish doctor who's also kind of gotten a name as a statistician and public health advocate, and he has some very well-loved TED Talks where he talks about the way that the world's getting better and better.
Say his name again.
Hans Rosling.
How do you spell?
H-A-N-S. R-O-S-L-I-N-G, and I'll have a little image of his book. Okay. So a lot of this material, you know, this may be super unsatisfying, but I had two sessions, so I had to break it up somehow. This is going to be looking at some of the material from his book, Factfulness. But he's done this quiz all over the world, and it's called Gapminder, Mind the Gap, Misperceptions About the World. And, I mean, this sample, I think, originally is from the data that we're going to look at right now is about 10,000 adults. And then they have them from online surveys, much, much larger, but they have them from a lot of different countries. So you can go ahead and look at some of the responses. But for the first one, in all low-income countries across the world today, how many girls finish primary school? The right answer would be 60%. You'll see the right answer in green, and then you'll see the responses from most of the rest of the world. So you can see, like, in general, only 7% of people got that one correct in these surveys. Most of the people thought it was much lower, like 20%. And you can see the spread by different countries. One of the things that's fun to watch in this, because he's from Sweden and he's kind of been a talking personality for a little while, Sweden tends to do a little better on these quizzes than on some of the other ones, but not across the board. Go ahead and you can keep track of how many you get, just out of curiosity. I like to write it down. Where does the majority of the world population live? Right answer would be middle-income countries. In the last 20 years, the proportion of people living in extreme poverty worldwide has almost halved. Yeah, that's another one where like 7% of folks are like aware of that. What is the life expectancy of the world population? And 70 years. There are 2 billion children in the world today, aged 0 to 15 years old. How many children will there be in the year 2100 according to the United Nations? The correct answer is about 2 billion. South Korea did exceptionally well. The United Nations predicts that by 2100, the world population will have increased another 4 billion people. What is the main reason? There will be more adults aged 15 to 74. How did the number of deaths per year from natural disasters change over the last 100 years? The correct answer is decreased to less than half. Which feels very different from, you know, a lot of the things that we witness. There are roughly 7 billion people in the world today. Which map best shows where they live? And the correct answer would be A, in terms of the distribution among the different continents. How many of the world's one-year-old children today have been vaccinated against some disease? 80%?
The world is getting better.
Worldwide, 30-year-old men have spent 10 years in school on average. How many years have women of the same age spent in school? The correct answer is 9 years.
Is it a bigger gap if you look at above primary?
That's a really good question. Yes, I'm sure it would be.
Yeah, I think it's still a huge gap there, but I think the primary is getting closer.
Yeah, and I will point out, this is, by the end of this conversation, I think you'll appreciate why it's being presented this way. But these are kind of cherry-picked statistics.
Yeah.
Tigers, giant pandas, and black rhinos were listed as threatened species in 1996. Since then, have any of these species become more critically endangered? Correct answer, none of them.
Because they were already so critically endangered.
So the black rhino is still critically endangered. I have to look at this. I tried to have him memorized, but he actually has detailed explanations for each of these questions on the Gap Manager website. One of them stayed critically endangered, but the other two either improved slightly or were at a less critical status.
That's the black rhino that stayed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many people in the world have some access to electricity? Correct answer, 80%.
Wow. 80%?
Mm-hmm. Global climate experts believe that over the next 100 years, the average temperature will get warmer. So a lot of people on the same page with regard to that. So just out of curiosity, how did y'all do? So how many got, like 13, so we'll say 5. Go ahead and keep your hand up.
If we got wrong.
Correct.
5 correct.
Well, correct. Yeah.
Wait, so less than 5.
Let me correct your papers.
5 or 5 or, okay. How many got?
Why don't you give us some time to
Oh, to tally it up? Okay, yeah. If you want to take just a minute.
It didn't take me long to tally.
So it looks like about half of them got 5. Okay, 6. Just keep your hand up. 6. Couple people. 7. Okay. 8. I got 8 when I first did this. I don't know if this is like my area of expertise. If that's any consolation. Yeah, so... Yeah, this is a really helpful way to think about some of the ways that data are being used to tell a particular story, as well as to try and think about the stories that we've already internalized based on the information sources that we're exposed to. So we're going to do a quick, what's called a think, pair, share. So in pairs, you're going to discuss the following question, and then depending on how we're doing with time, we'll have some time to report back. Why is there a disconnect between our perception and the reality of developed worldwide? And if you can think of maybe just 3 reasons, I say 5 here, but 3 reasons why we might have this disconnect between our perceptions and what's going on. So I'll give you, you know, about a minute or 2 minutes just to talk with the partner.
Yeah.
And think about why is there this disconnect.
We're just proceeding vocally and don't have much information about Indonesia. Yeah,
Get our information.
What you watch, what you watch. It's so cool.
So, and of course, you need statistics in your bank.
Okay. Well done.
So again, are you reading every all the time?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. For some of these groups who generated their list, what are some of the reasons that you came up with? Lack of information about the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not necessarily. So our focus is local.
What's another one?
If it bleeds, it leaves.
Yeah. Bad news. Okay, what else?
NGOs are some of the purveyors of information, and it's in the fundraising interest to emphasize the need.
Yeah, perverse incentives with the information, as well as the need that's articulated.
We said something related, but I think it was an outcome. If people think that the problem is enormous, then there's no hope until I bother. So there's a disincentive to do something about helping the current problem.
Okay, so people were less likely to be aware of the overwhelming problems because we would maybe feel more empathetic? Or maybe?
So I think so many of us thought that the problems were worse than they were.
Uh-huh.
And if I think that the problem is too enormous to make an impact, maybe I'm going to try to deal with something more local.
I see.
Whereas, in fact, it isn't impossible to make an impact, and I just don't know about it.
Yeah.
Are you saying despair has something to do with what you want to look at?
Yeah.
Yeah, we came down on, right away, all three of us, said, it's what you watch and what you watch and what you hear.
Yeah.
In other words, the sources from which we get our information. What are they telling us? Do we always watch and listen to that with which we agree most often?
Yes. Yeah, totally.
What's an NGO?
A non-governmental organization. Okay. Anything, yeah, non-government or non-bilateral something.
Kind of rose out of our thinking and a comment about the NGOs working for their bottom line to make things look worse than they are. But it also seems to work for this story that we need to protect ourselves because the rest of the world is in such bad shape.
Yeah.
Politically, for the people that use that as their energy, this story works.
Yeah. Like a protective posture. All right. Wow, I don't know what that is. Am I turning too quickly? Sorry. And this won't be exhaustive, but it's helpful just to have a couple of these ideas that came up. Anything else that folks would want to add to this list?
We just started discussing it, so we haven't even discussed it.
I'm sorry. That was a little bit.
That's why it's a little hard.
But that's
to
what we came up with. Though.
All right.
Yeah.
That's what's
coming. So, I just also would question some of the questions and the answers.
Sure.
Non-defined terms and so on.
Yeah, there are.
Like life expectancy in the world today, according to who?
I will say they source. The data sources themselves are fairly solid, and this would probably be from like World Health Organization. But again, yeah, if that's a good question mark, then I think that's worth asking about. Yeah.
We talked about lack of curiosity.
Okay.
We certainly have access to the information, but there are many of us, I speak for myself, who don't access it. We don't dig in very deeply.
Yeah.
Priorities. I might rather wish to be entertained than to learn something some of the time.
Yes.
And some people are trying very hard to survive their own reality and don't really have a lot of extra time to look up and out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't just we might perceive that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nope. It's not our problem yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which makes me think about the fact that we're blind about how limited the problems are. Mm-hmm. And that it is in our own interest to be
interested. Yeah.
And
this will be a theme hopefully we get to pick up if anyone's around tomorrow, but thinking about our responsibilities in participating in this global system and how our interconnectedness and interdependence sometimes gets hidden under these stories that we've been told about development and about poverty. So a lot of this information that will be on these next slides is from this book called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. And I commend his work. He's an incredible advocate, an animated presenter. He does a really good job in his TED Talks. They're very entertaining to watch. And then I also really appreciated this book, although you'll see at the end, there's going to be a little bit of pushback. And there'll be one more slide at the very end with some of the books that I want to recommend. So Hans Rosling and his kids, when they wrote this book, they identified 10 different instincts that they really wanted to call out as being partially responsible for some of these tendencies that we have and how we internalize these stories, and even in the ways that we look at the information that's available. So he's a big data person. He's really interested in trying to figure out what's actually happening when the Ebola virus is breaking out in West Africa. How can we tell if this is a crisis that mandates, you know, a very serious intervention versus, you know, a more conservative, constrained intervention? So we'll just go through these. One of them, you know, the first one he says, we're often tempted to recognize gaps in stories. And what we need to remember that when a story's talking about a gap, it usually is depicting, you know, two separate groups. But the reality is often not as polarized as being depicted. Often there's a majority that's a bit hidden. So the first one they would say is locate the majority. This is a picture that kind of, this is one of his really famous ways of displaying data. He likes the bubbles that show, the bubbles are the approximate population size. Each one of them represents a country. And then the axes, if you ever go to gapminder.com, you can make any graph that you want. You can put GDP on the y-axis, and you can put CO2 emissions on the x-axis. And you can do it for the last however many years of data are available, last 100 years, we can watch the progression. It's a very effective way of talking about some of these issues and the way they've changed over time. But in this graph, we're looking at the children surviving to the age 5, the percent of children that survive to the age 5, and then the number of children that are born to a woman. And so you can see, you know, the world feels pretty separate here, right? Like you have kind of big families and many children die, small families and few children die. The thing that's tricky though is this is 1965.
Oh.
And this is what that looks like today. And so, you know, part of his work is trying to say we've had these categories of first, second, third that are very outdated and politically inappropriate. Also, we have industrialized and developed, or developed and underdeveloped. And these categories are no longer very helpful because they're not describing the reality. And, you know, after we go through this, I'll share a little bit of what he suggests is a potentially better way to try and capture some of the nuances and differences. But this is one example where, you know, we're tempted to think these few categories, but actually the actual picture, depending on what you're looking at, is a little bit more complex. Similarly, you know, this is just looking at graphs. Easy to see big differences in SAT scores when you have a y-axis that's being constructed this way. Same thing in earnings. If you change the y-axis so that it's on a different scale, suddenly that gap looks a lot less substantial, both for wages and for SAT scores. Although I questioned his using the logarithmic scale. a little artistic liberty there. Yeah. But I can really appreciate this, right? Because every time you're looking at the average, you're really hiding a whole lot of information, right? An average is just one value in an entire distribution. So when you're looking at differences in SAT scores, when you look at it this way, there's way more similarity than there is difference. Here you can see some pretty significant distinctions between earnings, between those both contexts, but you also see that there's a lot of overlap. And this gives us a better way to think about where's the majority, how is the outcome distributed, not just looking at the particular mean. Another tendency we have is kind of a human tendency to think that things are often getting worse. But we can counter this tendency by just learning to expect that most of the news is going to be bad news. One example that he gives of this is looking at the share of people. This is a survey that's asked every year. And the question is there more crime in the U.S. than there was a year ago or less? And you can see the response. This is the perception. More crime, more crime. There were 2 years where they felt like there was less crime than more crime. Reality is that there was only 1 year where they actually matched up. People's perception was crime is getting worse and worse, but the reality has been actually the opposite. In terms of extreme poverty, we can have a long and extended conversation about how this metric is actually measured and the extent to which this metric is potentially inappropriate, or even the ways that the line itself, is this somewhat arbitrary line in the sand. But if you take the definitions that have been used and that are being used to try and make progress on development goals, you can see that according to that metric, there's a lot less people who are living on less than $2 a day compared to when they first started gathering data or when they first started estimating that data.
Does that take inflation into account?
All of the data attempts to account not only for inflation and like the way that the value of money changes over time, but also the way that money has different purchasing power parity in different contexts. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, but whether or not it's done well is actually a different question. And there'll be another book that I recommend that has a very substantial, I think, valid critique of this. Another way that we tend to look at data is that we assume that trends will just continue as straight lines. But we can counter that tendency by imagining, that the lines don't always have to be straight. Straight lines are in some ways kind of rare, but there are a lot of examples. So like life expectancy compared to income, GDP per capita, that's a fairly solid and fairly straight line. Similarly, if you look at like schooling, average length of education in years versus income, or the average marrying age for young women, or the amount of time or the share of income used for recreation and culture, all those tend to be pretty straight lines. But when you look at literacy, vaccination rates, or fridges, you have something different, like an S-curve, right? Where your ability to get some of the most important things first ends up being saturated when you're at these different income levels as a country, so that by the time you're at the highest income level, you've actually, most of the people have been able to achieve their vaccinations or their fridges or achieve higher literacy. Similarly, there are slides. So you can see that this is babies per women. And again, this is another measure of income. Each of the five income groups represents about 20% of the population, and this is from 2013. The idea is here, like after a certain amount of security and stability, suddenly having a lot of kids is no longer necessary because there's a lot better chance that they're going to survive. And then there's also what he calls the humps, right? Where you have some dynamics that really peak in these middle-income categories associated with like cavities, traffic deaths, or children drowning. And that's, in an instance, he uses the example of like the tomato plant. A tomato plant that doesn't have enough water is going to starve. It's going to be water-stressed. It's not going to thrive. But that doesn't mean you just keep throwing water on it, right? It'll just be oversaturated. And a lot of these situations, before you're able to have the institutions or the societal structures to support some of these services, you can have some kind of peak incidents until those are in place. And then you have some dynamics where you actually have doubling or like exponential growth. And it's interesting to see like transportation and traveling is one of those dynamics. So travel distance, average distance traveled annually in thousands of miles. As you have more disposable income, you're doing a lot more traveling. Spending, in terms of share of income spent on vehicles and transport, also goes up, it doubles. And then CO2 emissions, because those are very, very tightly connected to transportation and to traveling. So when we look at something like population growth, it's tempting to think that that's just gonna go like a hockey stick, you know, straight up. But there's other options, and in fact, there's a lot of trends that we can look at to see how things are actually maybe going to level off or begin to decrease in ways that we wouldn't have anticipated before. Another dynamic is our innate fear of danger or scary possibilities. But you have to ask yourself, is it actually scary? Is it dangerous? This is a key, by the way. So we can resist that by trying to control our fears. Our natural fears of violence, captivity, and contamination make us systematically overestimate risks. We need to calculate the risks. So in terms of deaths from disasters, I don't know, some of this is probably old news for you folks, but the reality is we get a lot of news about airplane crashes, deaths from terrorism, and natural disasters. But when you look at the data, it's actually quite compelling to see how much things have decreased. So annual death per million of people, 10-year averages, has gone down precipitously.
I have a question on
yeah.
that. If you did this just in total numbers of people, is that also down?
This is actually not per million,
and I'm saying we've multiplied the population of the Earth quite a bit since 1930 or 1940. So are we really having more deaths, just it's a smaller percentage of the population?
Yeah, this is in absolute terms, not in proportions. So you're asking whether or not, if we take into account, it's a really good point.
Bangladesh is an excellent location because there's so many people. Every time there's a cyclone, there's more deaths there than there may have been when there were no people there.
Right. Yeah. No. And it's a very good point. And this is actually a lot of the debate in sustainable and Millennium Development Goals has been moving the goalposts from looking at decreases in absolute numbers to now looking at them in proportions. Some people say that was a bad move. But in these cases, the drops have been so much that whether you're looking at proportions or absolute numbers, it's all less. Significantly less than before.
And does disaster include war in this?
We're going to get to war.
Okay. Well, natural disaster would be the hurricanes and the landslides.
Cyclones, earthquakes.
And volcanic eruptions and things like that. So you would think that we would have had more.
Well, it does seem like we've had more, doesn't it? We're aware.
It devastates large numbers of people. They lose their lives, like the one that's in Haiti. You're talking about thousands of people in one episode losing their lives.
I totally agree with you. I think one of the realities is that before we weren't aware of just how many folks were impacted by natural disasters. Whereas now we're hyper-connected to what's going on in the world.
I would think, is that one instance where technology has really made a drastic difference in people surviving disasters? Because
I couldn't say in terms of surviving.
Or do we think there's less disasters?
Oh no, there's probably more disasters. And I guess it depends on what type of technology. Yeah. Like, if you think about the Bahamas, I don't know what the current number of reported mortalities is,
yeah.
But I think if you go back not too far, it would have been much higher for that forcefulness of a storm. And now you have storms that are more forceful than before and more frequent.
Yeah.
But you have fewer deaths, potentially because people are building their houses more, or there's evacuation
Evacuation notice. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, in that regard, yeah, maybe the ability to predict and better meteorology might be helping. That's a good question. Earthquakes, probably not. So plane crashes, again, when we hear that one crashes, it's a really big deal. But we never hear, in 2017, it was the safest year on record. I think that's usually not in the news. I'm so sorry, I don't know why it does that. Battle deaths, so getting more towards war. Again, you know, you can see some of the, you know, large world wars. And a lot of these are estimates because I think it was hard to come by. I don't think people were doing the best job telling these things back in the 1900s. But historians try to, you know, reconstruct the narrative and reconstruct data as well as they can. But I think the overall picture is that things have gone down significantly. Yeah.
An interesting thing my daughter tells me, she's an army kid, I don't know how it's verifiable, is that it's more likely to be killed in a school shooting than it is in active duty.
Isn't that terrifying?
Yeah.
It would be interesting to look at that data. It's kind of like when people say, you know, it's much more dangerous to drive than it is to fly.
Yeah.
And you just have to take into account, like, hours spent, you know, you have to do it on a per mile basis, which I think is one of the best ways to compare. Mm-hmm. It would be hard to compare active duty versus school. But, yeah, if you're looking at, like, total time spent in a school, well, but it's not just necessarily absolute. If you looked at it on a proportion, you would probably be, anyways. It is a terrifying example. but it's also kind of a sad testament, you know, to where we're at, right?
It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, see, that could be one of those things where you would want to push back and be like, well, is it like the airplane crash that gets reported and makes people terrified to fly? Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to actually look that up. So sometimes we see a single number in isolation and we're like, well, that's huge, but compared to what? You know, sometimes it's important to be able to check proportions like you were bringing up before. So in terms of the number of people who are non-Westerners in these different income categories, because of the way that population is distributed and because of the way that, you know, this lower distribution right here is the number of people living in the West. You can see we're a much smaller part of the population, but currently we're still the majority in this fourth level of income. By 2027, that's predicted to be pretty much on par. And then in 2040, even though the majority of the world's population will still potentially be, they're kind of slowly shifting into level three over here, they will have overtaken. This gray area here will actually be more than the number of people in the West where the majority of the folks are living level four. There's also a temptation to kind of equate or conflate things as being kind of all the same, but you have to take into account some of the nuances and difference in the different categories. So we can try and avoid sweeping generalizations, of which I'm sure you will catch me making several. So this is kind of a temptation that we all have. One example is talking about Africa. Really not always helpful to try and talk about the African continent when you have some countries like Somalia, Ghana, or Tunisia, which are in very different places in terms of life expectancy or in terms of income, like GDP per capita. So we have to try and be as specific as possible. There's also a temptation to be like, well, it's kind of inevitable. But we can also ask ourselves, are things slowly changing? And we can try and appreciate that change happens over time, sometimes in ways we don't anticipate it. So this is one example looking at the number of children born to women in Iran. And you can see from most of the data that we have available, it was really high. Like 7 children on average. And there was a precipitous drop over the course of about 10 years, about 40 years. And, you know, for some folks, it's easy to say, oh, all Middle Eastern countries are probably going to have more of a propensity to have higher number of children being born in each family. But in fact, you know, in some countries, there's been incredible progress, and sometimes that's not often taken into account. This is true even when you look across different religious groups. So in terms of the different levels of income and then the number of babies born per women, it's actually very similar across Christian, Muslim, and then other different, like other religious groups. One of the much better explanatory variables or explanations for why this decreases is the ability for those children to survive. Mm-hmm. We have a tendency to, when we're hammered, to think that most of the problems are nails. So this can kind of limit our imagination for what we should do. So to control this, we want to try and figure out what are some of the other solutions. We want to try and look at different or multiple tools to understand not only how we can understand these problems, but also to figure out what we can do to address them. One example is just the way that we frame things. So when you look at life expectancy again and then GDP per capita, this is in 1995, you could say Cuba is the healthiest of the poor countries. Mm-hmm. But it might also be accurate to say that Cuba is the poorest of the healthy countries, because they actually have a life expectancy that's quite phenomenal for the GDP per capita that they're working with. On the other hand, the United States spends more on health than any other country, but our life expectancy is actually significantly less compared to other countries. So you could say the United States is the sickest of the rich.
Is diet the major factor?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I'm sure that it's multiple factors. The ability to spend this much of your income on health, you know, is also fairly unique. And it's also an indication of a much higher GDP per capita. But there's a lot of other countries like Costa Rica that have higher life expectancies.
Is the U.S. gone down?
That's a good question. I wouldn't be able to say. I'd say overall it's definitely gone up, like if you look over the last 200 years, but I don't think we've dipped recently. In this last video I'm going to show you, you'll actually see this is an average, and when we actually break this apart, you'll see different trends for different parts of the population. Finally, factfulness is recognizing when there's a scapegoat that's being used and remembering that blaming an individual often steals focus from other possible explanations. So to control this, we need to resist, you know, finding that scapegoat. This is particularly important when we think about climate change, and I think for everybody in this room, this isn't going to be surprising. There are some folks who are terrified that as the rest of the world begins to develop, there's going to be CO2 emissions that are going to make the rest of the planet uninhabitable. But the reality is, the folks who are still at level 4 are responsible for the majority of the emissions still. And that's not even taking into consideration the historical amount of emissions that have been emitted. So there is a reality that developing countries are going to use things probably like fossil fuels and industrialized capitalism in order to improve their living conditions, but we need to be able to take the log out of our own eyes. Factfulness is recognizing when a decision feels urgent and remembering that it rarely is. Sometimes we can control that tendency by taking small steps towards different solutions. Because Hans is epidemiologist, kind of a public health advocate, you know, he would point out that there are some risks that are very significant, like Spanish flu. I mean, that hurt life expectancy and had a significant dip and affected a large portion of people. And those are things that are worth thinking about. So for him, advancing public health goals to make sure that countries that are particularly vulnerable have the resources to be able to address these concerns as they arise is an overarching priority. So these are what, you know, they would call the 10 factfulness commandments. And I think these are some of the ways, in addition to what you all were already talking about, that we can counter some of our innate tendencies that make it easier for bad news to get internalized, mm-hmm. or make it easier for us to accept the bad news narrative that we are often exposed to. How are you going to do it? Do you want to do a stretch break? All right, let's do a stretch break. 3:47, so about 3:50. 3 minutes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
How about turning it off while you fix it?
I'm not taking one of those photos.
Should I write it down?
I do not, but I'm going to share this slide. Sorry, it doesn't like it.
I'm going to fix before I worship tomorrow.
I just want to bring up the subject.
You think you got a new cord somewhere?
No. The story I've heard many times is that the civilian pilot won't fly on safe equipment. So that's why we have to save aircraft to fly.
Okay.
Because he's in the plane when he's flying.
You can
run out. Whereas the military pilot probably missions to bomb a city that he might not be flying.
He's still going. They had the global warming and they got the population.
Separate those kind of subjects.
Okay. I won't be offended or wasted.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terribly sorry, and it makes me resentful.
No.
It's
weather.
For me, in a plane, that doesn't do what people
think. But I came
so all my data was based on what I was doing.
35
years ago.
John.
Yeah, I've never made a sweater.
You and I both took a picture of that. I have my phone out.
Yeah,
okay.
That's one of those things where we have to hear that slowly built an unsafe plane. And that was that.
Don't worry about me.
She made a sound score for our great granddaughter. It turned out beautiful.
So underestimated.
That's definitely something.
And somehow the sleeves come on naturally as you work your way down from the neck to the waist.
Yeah.
Just keep knitting and the sleeves show up.
I did a pattern like that. But the problem is that the sleeves were there and the rest of the sweater was there.
Because there's a certain connection that I think
you can
use.
I'm really impressed about how thoughtful the whole audience is, the Holden population.
It's the Holden population, and there's an automatic filter. Only the people who come here who are interested are here. So the ones who don't care are not here. Hey, I have I couldn't understand.
Women are favored in tribes.
We were more like each other than our churches at home, and I'm going.
But so are the people.
Two girls have the same mother tongue, same denomination. Everybody else is different. What is it? And one of the Norwegian gals said, think of the filters that got us here. Of course, it'll be more like each other.
Yeah, it'll be a continuation of the
theme. Wow, I never thought of that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your perspective.
But I paid attention a lot since then.
Well, I have to pay a lot more. Yeah. I'm sure of that.
Right.
And if I had a professional doctor, I'm not going to help you even.
You just don't carry around with you all of this.
But I do.
South America, right? Because I heard you talking Spanish to your son.
Yeah.
Your accent sounds pretty legit.
It's not as awesome as it used to be, but in fact, if I wasn't trying to teach some Spanish, I feel like I would have lost a lot of it.
There are some.
Bueno, escuela y también estudié en Chile por un semestre, pero también trabajando con Tierra Nueva. It'll be a remote position. Yeah, they have a Portland office that I'll be working out of part of it, but most of the time I'll just be in my garage, which is how I've worked the last 3 years.
I always worry about the long term.
Tuesday, Wednesday.
She's the biggest.
I should have changed that. Thank you for catching that. That's originally how we planned it, but then now it's going to be
Tuesday. Live in a house that has outgassings, or live in a city where there's
food security,
whatever.
We won't talk about it. It is an important one.
I mean, she's a really extreme.
There's two of them, right?
I'm sorry, will you be sitting there?
Come over here.
It comes up in different, you know, ways. One used to be
your other half. I'm sorry. Chris, I interrupted.
What?
So I'm just curious. Bringing back this. For the folks who are here, and this is just a popcorn question, which of these instincts do you feel like personally is one of the more challenging ones, you know, to kind of like keep under, not keep under wraps, but to be able to counter? Like, which of these do you feel like we in general, or even you personally, are particularly vulnerable or susceptible to?
I was just telling her that number three, I have the most difficulty because if something is going up at a constant rate, why would I predict that it would start to curve off?
Yeah.
So yeah. When you showed that graph, I was like, what?
Yeah.
You know, why?
Yeah.
I mean, we know that things have a carrying capacity and all that, but we don't really know what that is yet.
Right.
And that would tie into seven, too. Notice slow changes might not alarm you, but there might be some data you could see that is making that line curve, but slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not.
I think two and four are maybe just me, but because the negative news, that it increases the fear factor.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of a feedback loop.
I totally agree. Anyone else? All right, well, we are getting close to the end of our time. I'm going to actually skip to the thing. Oh, man, I just totally, 4:15 is the end, right? Yeah, okay. So we're gonna skip ahead. And then I'm just gonna show you these slides so that if you wanna sit down for dinner or a meal, you wanna ask me about any of these things, I'm happy to talk to you about them. But this is Hans Rosling's kind of proposed way to take into account the different things like water, transport, cooking, and food, so that we can get an idea of what does life actually look like when we're talking about four different levels of humanity,
right,
and the distribution of the population. And they actually have a thing online that I think they call it Dollar Street. I don't know exactly why they call it that, but it gives you an opportunity to look in people's homes. Like they get, and it's not just individuals, but they really try to make it very tangible and real, which I really appreciate. But you know, he has a script where he kind of talks about how, you know, at this level, you're going to be sleeping on the floor, eating very similar meals each time, cooking with a lot of indoor air pollution, barefoot, and often having to go and retrieve your water, you know, some distance. And then those dynamics change as you kind of look at different levels and categories. And this is just looking at these different levels. Like when I was in Colombia, you know, it was really helpful to see, like, yeah, we're actually in level two, or level three here.
GNI is what?
Gross national income.
Oh.
Another potential measure.
And that's just the formal sector, or is that including an estimate of the informal?
That would be formal. I would be surprised. This is just from World Bank.
Okay.
Paradigms and development. This was another activity I had planned where, you know, we could look at the ways that we relate to capitalism. You know, some people would argue, post-fall of the Soviet Union, it's not really a question about whether development is a way to transform society. It's more like, are you becoming an industrialized capitalist country, or are you trying to resist some of those free market tendencies? So this author does a really good job trying to break down the ways that we relate to capitalism, and then how that informs the way we approach development. So, looking at, this is a paradigm that's been kind of dominant within the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It's been used to, in some ways, advance a lot of agendas that weren't necessarily helpful for the countries where those policies were being enacted. This would be more middle of the road, like capitalism is a reality, but we need to try to do more interventions, either by governing the market, you know, through policies and institutions, or just trying to make it more efficient, trying to take into account market failures. Then you have kind of development against capitalism, which would be more of a structuralist argument, and this would be much more of a critical stance in relation to capitalism and development in general. And this is where you get some books like Dead Aid, you know, where there's an argument, and even if folks are fans of Bill Easterly, saying that like aid itself is the problem in terms of fostering the tendency, or trying to promote policies that are going to be beneficial to the countries that are promoting them, but not to the countries that are receiving them. And then there's also the rejection of development, the post-development school. But I think this next video is going to be much more germane to this conversation, and I want to respect people's time. So this is, I think it's about 10 minutes long. And this is a way to ask about another way of looking at the data, or maybe another way of saying it is looking at different data and asking ourselves, how does that change our perception?
You might have heard that the world is steadily becoming better and better. That the annual number of war casualties has plummeted 90% during the last 70 years. Or that global child mortality has seen a tenfold decrease since the beginning of the 19th century. You might also have seen visualizations like this one, with a per capita income along this axis, life expectancy along this axis, and all the different nations represented by bubbles where color and size mirror the continents and the number of inhabitants. And you might have seen how all nations during the last two centuries have enjoyed an ever-increasing lifespan and more earnings to buy things. What you've seen is true. These are facts that can't be denied, and they do say something important about the world. Today, however, they are being used for propaganda purposes, to justify the existing state of affairs and hail Western capitalism as the ideal society. Both politicians and scientists do this, and they do it by emphasizing some facts to the extreme while completely ignoring other facts. Take a look at these bubbles, for instance. Is this really what the world looks like? Look at the US and all its inhabitants neatly packed in this small little bubble. Why is it so small? Because it represents the mean values of income and lifespan, not reality. In reality, all national income is unequally distributed. So among the bottom half of the American population, the average income is $16,000 per year, much lower than the national average. For this half of the US, income has remained roughly the same for four decades. So why does the national average income increase? To understand, we have to look at the entire distribution up to the top 1%. And to do that, we have to zoom out a bit. Among the American top 1%, the average income is $1.3 million. Now, listen carefully. Since the share of all national income going to the top 1% is almost twice as large as the share going to the bottom half of the population, whatever happens up there has a huge impact on the national average. And so, during the last 35 years, the top 1% has more than tripled its income, while the poorest half of the population has remained just as poor. That's why national averages can be so misleading. Inequalities like this affect how long people live. An American woman belonging to the top 1% has an average life expectancy of 89 years. Whereas an American man belonging to the bottom 1% has an average life expectancy of 73 years, about the same as in Bangladesh. Mind the gap? Yes, they have a gap at about 16 years, and the US is not that exceptional in this respect. If we zoom in on Sweden, where I come from, a relatively egalitarian society, you can take a Stockholm tube from the well-educated inhabitants of Danderyd to the less educated inhabitants of Vårbygård. This trip will only take a few minutes, but when you arrive, life expectancy will have dropped 18 years. All this is going on beneath the national averages. But even if we look at national averages, it is far from evident that industrial capitalism produces better and better living conditions into infinity. If we look at the UK and the US, for instance, average life expectancy has actually gone down during recent years. Not because the rich are dying earlier, of course. What we see is an increase in so-called deaths of despair. That is, deaths caused by suicide, alcohol, and drug overdoses.
Wow.
Despair, you might ask. Yes. That's something else that is rarely mentioned whenever the health benefits of economic growth are promoted. Have you ever heard any of these advocates of capitalism talk about mental health? After all, looking at the entire world, the leading cause of ill health today is not a physical illness, but depression. About a tenth of the global population suffer from it, and all in all, so-called mental disorders account for about a third of disability worldwide. So why would anyone interested in global health want to ignore this particular type of suffering? Here's why. This is the world of depression. The redder a country is, the more its inhabitants are suffering from depression disorders. As you can tell, the most depressed populations can be found in Europe, Australia, and the US. This is the world of anxiety. Here you see the same pattern. Lots of anxiety disorders in the Americas, Europe, Australia. Not so much anxiety in Africa and Asia. Strange, isn't it? It looks as if the richer a nation is, the more problems it has with people being anxious and depressed. But wasn't economic growth supposed to save us from our misery? Now, I'm going to show you all the eating disorders in the world, all the anxiety disorders, all bipolar disorders, all depressive disorders, all drug abuse disorders, all alcohol abuse disorders, and all the schizophrenia. This is how the global burden of disease, that is how much people are suffering, is distributed among high-income nations, upper-middle-income nations, lower-middle-income nations, and low-income nations. Yes, the richer a nation is, the more its inhabitants are likely to suffer. And there you have it. The reason why so few talk about the global distribution of mental illness is because the pattern doesn't fit into the notion of economic growth as a panacea to all human problems. Nor does it fit into the notion that the world is becoming better and better. During the last 25 years, both poor and rich are actually suffering more and more. You can measure this in several ways, but it doesn't matter whether you look at medical records or ask people about symptoms in national surveys. Or if you consider the consumption of antidepressants, which only in the so-called developed nations belonging to OECD, has doubled in only 15 years. All numbers point in the same direction. That doesn't mean that economic growth necessarily makes us unhappy. No, it can definitely make us happier when some material necessities in life are satisfied. But once the growth reaches a certain level, its effect on our well-being tends to weaken. If we look at the US economic growth since 1972, for instance, it has more than doubled. Yet according to the most reliable surveys we have, the happiness of Americans has remained roughly the same and even weakened somewhat. This begs the question why economic growth should be endlessly pursued. But even more fundamentally, one could ask if health of any kind is relevant when assessing the merits of a society. Let's have a look at these bubbles illustrating the average income and lifespan again. This time, I highlighted some of the world's dictatorships. Look at them. Look at the very fast progress they all make. How Singapore is an outchance all Western nations on both income and lifespan. What does this tell us? Do these nations also represent good societies? Is it preferable to live in Qatar than in the US, where people, on average, are poorer and die earlier? If we zoom in on China, we see that life expectancy grew spectacularly fast between 1949 and 1976. This is one of the fastest growths in life expectancy ever registered, contributing to the fact that in less than 30 years, Chinese life expectancy more than doubled. During this period, China was also governed by Mao Zedong, one of the worst dictators history has ever seen. What does this tell us? That Mao's China represented a good society? Not counting the Great Famine here in the middle, where at least 15 million people died in vain. Does it tell us that it's good to live in authoritarian communism, where those who criticize the ruling elite risk their lives? If not, why is this kind of statistical cherry-picking acceptable when it comes to demonstrating the benefits of capitalism? Maybe life expectancy and other health measures are poor indicators of what kind of society we live in. Maybe we shouldn't only look at the society as it is, but also consider its potential, what it could be. Regardless of how you see it, though, the world isn't only becoming a better place. In many respects, we see the reverse. I've mentioned mental health problems, but the increase in inequality, housing shortage, and precarization of the labor market also deserves our attention. Pretending as if these problems do not exist is dishonest and a glaring example of poor social science. These problems can be solved, but they need to be acknowledged. To exclusively proclaim the perpetual improvement of the world is not going to help. Should we say something about global warming?
Without even talking about global warming. Not the most positive note to end on. But I hope this is helpful for trying to understand that there's a lot of different stories that we are exposed to and that we need to learn how to criticize and be able to bear under scrutiny. And so we can actually, we have, you know, it's actually 4:15, but over different meals, we can have a good conversation about the extent to which some of the statistics, even in this video, were cherry-picked. But I think it's a really helpful corrective to some of these narratives. I took a little bit of a risk. I wasn't sure. Sometimes you, in some presentations, you're trying to convince people actually the world is getting better, and it's helpful to actually be exposed to some of that data. And then I was like, but I'm not fully satisfied with that narrative myself. I want to actually also provide the counter narrative, which is a really good pushback looking at the ways that the world itself is not necessarily improving in some areas. I hope it wasn't too much information.
What's his name again? And is that findable by normal people or just you?
Oh no, this is on YouTube.
Okay.
And it's very, very findable. Let me just go to the beginning of it.
Did you buy it or can I have it too?
I'm just going to let it play and then I'll pause it right at what it says his name. If you type in better and better, Hans Rosling critique, that's how I found it the last time.
What is facade?
I'm sorry? Oh, I think that's the film production.
Okay. You might have heard
Roland Paulson.
Would you spell his name again?
Rosling?
Who's me? Yeah.
R-O-S-L-I-N-G.
Or O-S, okay.
That one was Roland.
Hello.
Roland Paulson.
The narrator. He's a Swede, of course it's Ian.
Well, and ironically, I think, you know, he's trying to counter some of this narrative that Hans Rosling, a Swede, has been promoting in this country, and so I have to say, we have a little bit of enmity. And if you're familiar with any of Hans Rosling's work, there's several like direct jabs in this narrative.
Yeah.
So, I shared at the beginning a little bit of the plan. But I'll just show the outline for tomorrow. It does say Thursday, but as somebody pointed out, it's tomorrow. And then Thursday will be my wife, and she'll be talking about radical hospitality. But yeah, I'll talk a little bit more about motivation, understanding access, water and sanitation, then energy complexity, and then there'll be maybe one or two options. How time comes up. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.